And if they stick together through that, there's something on the other side of a long-term relationship that's not available anywhere else. You know, if it's a conscious one, there's a level of intimacy and frankly, good sex that is just not available anywhere else. To monks on the mountain meditating and understanding truth, it's not available. There is something about exposing and fundamentally breaking yourself down to the point where you can be with another human that is that's an unsurpassable mystery.
That was Eric Newsom, and you are listening to the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. The All Things Risk podcast is where I go deep and long form with some fascinating people. I use the lenses of risk, resilience, and uncertainty to get into all types of wonderful topics. I'm based in London in the UK, and it's been quite a week here. Last week, as you will have likely heard, we had a lone wolf terrorist attack that tragically left 4 dead and a dozen injured. And, you know, as tragic as the events of last week were, I've talked a lot about terrorism in the past on this show. And it's, again, worthy of reminding ourselves that our chances of being killed in a terror attack are extremely small. Statistically speaking, we're more likely to be killed in a car accident or even slipping and falling in the bathroom. But what a terrorist wants is for us to dive into our fears and, you know, really attribute a much higher likelihood to such an event. And I'd also argue that for many political reasons, a number of leaders also want us to give into our fears. And arguably, so do people in the media. Some people in the media. If there's one city in the world that really doesn't buy this, I'd argue that it's London. And as tragic as last week's events were, the next day it was business as usual here. This is a city that's overcome the Blitz, the IRA bombings, the July 2005 bombings, and it really doesn't give in to unwarranted fear. Of course, you know, this is the city and the country of keep calm and carry on. And I think it's a city that also sees its diversity and its tolerance of others as a strength. And if anyone in the West is interested in, you know, winning the war on terror, and I have many thoughts about that, but we should and they should really look to London to really understand how it's done. Speaking of fear, on to this week's show. Today, we talk about risk in love and relationships. And I mention fear because it's not the kind of thing that I proclaim to be any kind of expert in. And if you asked me 2 years ago that I'd be hosting a podcast episode on this topic, I would have probably called you nuts. But this is the All Things Risk podcast, and you grow when you get out of your comfort zone. So here we are. My guest is Eric Newsom. Eric is a former family law attorney, a divorce lawyer, in other words, who describes himself as someone who's been through 1,000 divorces and still believes in love. And he has a really unique real-world understanding of what makes some marriages and relationships thrive and others fall apart. And what Eric does now is very interesting. He helps couples build healthy relationships. He's the co-founder of a site and a great podcast called Together. You can find that at www.together.guide. He's based in San Francisco in the United States, and he's a marriage commissioner over there. He's married 180 plus couples. And we had an awesome, super fun conversation that almost didn't happen. So also speaking of fear, I feared that I might have lost this episode due to a technical glitch, and somehow we managed to retrieve it. So I'm delighted to bring this conversation to you. We cover Eric's background, and it's a really cool story, how he got into becoming a divorce lawyer and what he learned during his time as a divorce lawyer. We talk about romantic love and its limitations, the common causes of divorce. We talk about conflict in relationships, being present in relationships, resilience in terms of post-divorce or a post-breakup situation. We talk about monogamy and open relationships. We get into a discussion about online dating and how all of that works, and really a lot more. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I know I say that all the time, but really, I've had so many cool people, and Eric is another wonderful, really insightful person that I'm sure you're going to enjoy listening to. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Eric Newton. Eric, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here. I think we're going to have a great conversation. So welcome.
Thanks, Ben. As I was saying, I'm really excited. I think this is going to be a fun talk.
I think it's going to be fun. But I have to admit, I'm a little bit slightly nervous and uncomfortable. And the reason why is because my show, we've never talked love on this show, and it's not my deal at all. I mean, it is because I'm a human being, but you know, I talk to adventurers, I talk to athletes, I talk to people who are economists and experts in various things. So this is a little different for me. So I'm curious to see how it goes.
Sounds like there's some risk at play.
Yeah, there is. There is. But you have to practice what you preach. So, you know, I wanted to get things started with your time as a divorce lawyer. Yeah. And I've listened to a few of your podcast episodes. You do not sound like a lawyer to me at all. So I don't know if that was a vocational error that you made along the way, or what it was, but I'd like to kind of start with a bit of your background and how you got into being a divorce lawyer. And I have to say that it's something that I never gave any thought to being personally, but yeah. So how do you end up there?
Well, I think it's pretty non-traditional. You know, a lot of people who go into law have a passion for this concept of justice, or, you know, there's something about the process of the legal system that really excites them. And I have an appreciation for that, certainly, but that wasn't what called me. I was on an adventure, if you want to know the truth. I had been running a nightclub business in D.C., and the 9/11 happened. And it destroyed the nightclub business in that city. As you can imagine, after the Pentagon got hit, nobody wanted to go out, and people were terrified of anthrax. And my partner and I were thinking, what's next? And I had always had this fantasy of first becoming an entrepreneurial billionaire. And then I would go back to law school as a gentleman scholar, you know, in order to get this finishing education. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not the billionaire yet, but why not accelerate the plan a little bit? So I applied to two schools, both in my town, got into both of them and chose one, and just went to law school. And you know, without any plans to ever practice law, just really for the absolute Hail Mary fun of it. And Mary might not be the right thing, because I wasn't trying to achieve some goal, but just for the heck of it. And and it turned out to be an absolute butt-kicking boot camp of a life-changing, intellectual, forming experience. But I still never wanted to be a lawyer. even after I got through law school, I didn't really practice law.
So
that's the first part of the story. And then the second part of the story is I did graduate from school, and I thought, well, the right thing to do is to take the bar exam, because, you know, you've got this degree. Mm. So I took the hardest bar I could find. California and New York are sort of a toss-up in the U.S. for which is the hardest. Mm. So I took California, and as soon as I took the bar, I said, well, that's that. I'd taken the test. I don't care what happens. And I went and worked on a documentary film in New York, which was a total disaster. And I lost my very meager savings in the process of working on this very ill-conceived documentary idea.
Well, I do hear lawyers can get well paid.
Well, so. Exactly. That's sort of exactly. So then I was thinking, well, what the heck am I going to do for money? Like, well, you know, I can't actually practice. So I moved to San Francisco, started to practice, and it turned out to be divorce.
Right.
It turned out to be good at it. So I stuck with it for a while.
Right. That's right. Did you sort of, was it divorce something that you chose, or was it just you fell into it, or
when I got to San Francisco, I was temping. It was the only way I could find any income to move to this city where I'd always wanted to live. So I had the insight, you know, I could hang out a shingle, because the worst thing that'll happen is I'll fail. You know, the investment is fairly low. I'm already, at that point, I had passed the bar. I'd found out that I'd passed. Mm. So I was a licensed attorney. I just had no intention up to that point of practicing. But why not? So I hung out a shingle, and I put out a very inexpensive ad on a website that was around at that time called Nolo, and started getting cases. People were calling me to help with their employment contract, their lemon law case with their automobiles, their disputes with the mattress company. I helped some old lady with a mattress company. And most of what was coming in was divorce law. And I didn't have any specific intention to be a divorce lawyer, but it was what was coming in the door. And then by another bit of happenstance, happened to network with this wonderful old man who was a celebrity divorce attorney, and he offered to take me under his wing. And he taught me, you know, how to work the divorce law business, walked me through my cases from beginning to end, and really mentored me in a way that was invaluable. And suddenly I turned around, and there I was, a divorce lawyer.
Right.
So then I just went with it.
Right. I'm curious about the mentality that goes into being a divorce lawyer. Is it, you know, I'm going to fight my client's corner, and I'm going to try, it's a zero sum game, and I'm going to try to extract everything I can get from the other side to help my client? Or is it much more nuanced than that?
You know, most young attorneys who get into divorce law are idealists, and they're doing it because they feel like they have something to contribute to society by being divorce attorney. Mm-hmm. And they go in thinking that it's not a zero-sum game, and they have something to add to the system. But the structure of our adversarial judicial system is such that it's very, very hard to break out of exactly what you've said, this mentality of it being a zero-sum game. And most divorce lawyers get jaded very quickly about the process. And, you know, they end up being fairly unhappy in life, I think, and providing service that, you know, it gets the job done and it pads their bank accounts, but it never feels like it makes a difference in the world. It's really hard. It is very, very hard to move against that system. And it can be done. I think in our best days, we did, and I definitely know other lawyers in this town who make it happen, but it's a tough, I mean, there's so much momentum behind the need to go in with your guns blazing.
Right.
Talk about risk.
Right.
Going into a divorce with your guns blazing is a huge risk. And in order for a client to be able to have the perspective that that's what they want to do, they have to have a real understanding of what they care about in life beyond the anger and the money.
Right.
And then they have to find an attorney who can support that view of the world consistently through the challenges that will arrive. That's a tall order.
Right. Yeah. And divorce is also incredibly expensive, isn't it? I mean, when a client went to see you, were they, you know, 90% of the way towards divorce, or was it, you know, were there cases where the marriage was already salvageable, or what did you find more or less? Was it often too late at that point the mind was made up? And
yeah, I mean, to answer the specific question of could they go back, you can always go back. You know, I mean, you can always reconcile. You can always find peace, I believe. But you're right. For the most part, if somebody's coming to a lawyer, it's a done deal. Now, we made a practice of always suggesting therapy and another attempt to work things out before finalizing. But I think in my entire 10-year career or 9-year career, that only happened 2 or 3 times.
It's wow.
Turned the ship around. So yeah.
Out of how many cases, more or less?
I have never added up. I think our firm, right. I think our firm ran several thousand altogether.
Wow.
Probably actually managed, in the several hundreds. I had in most of those cases.
Right. Right. Did you get some insight into, presumably you did, you got insight into these people's relationships and what went wrong and, where they took some missteps perhaps. What were some of the common themes or causes that were emerging?
Well, there's two levels to that. The first is what people say. What most people are tuned into is their complaints. And, complaints are legitimate. I don't want to diminish those. But the complaints usually fall in categories like challenges around money, sex, child rearing disagreements, use of time, kind of the basic arguments that we all have. And they get blown up and never managed and never solved. And then they turn into, it turns into a callus that can't be scrubbed away. But really, if you look below the complaints, that's what's fascinating to me. And in my work now, that's what's fascinating to me is what's below the complaint. What's really, really going on here? What does it take to give up your, to let go for a moment of your fear and your ego so that you can just have a genuine interaction with another human being? And I find that, I guess this is sort of my fundamental worldview, but it certainly is the case in divorce. What's really, really happening is that people are scapegoating one another with their own internal, subjective, unresolved traumas and fears, usually from childhood, but not always. And I'm very agnostic as to whether people divorce or stay together or, have kids or don't. I really don't care what people ultimately choose. But I just love when they take whatever they're experiencing in life as an opportunity to look within and understand their underlying mechanisms. Because that's where the juice is. That's where the opportunity to laugh at this ridiculous play that's unfolding before really lies, So I think self-awareness is the whole point, if there is one.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's almost like when we're in a in a relationship where you're never giving up yourself, right? You're never getting away from who you are,
right?
And you're bringing whatever baggage. It's the same thing. I have the same sort of same analogy with travel, right? That I love travel, and moving to another place and visiting another place is great, but the one variable that's still the same is you, regardless of the relationship that you're in.
It's that old phrase, wherever you go, there you are.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, same thing in a relationship. Whoever you're dating, whomever you're dating, or whatever the relationship circumstances, you're still there.
Yeah.
And your feelings are your own. That can't be said enough times. And you hear it hackneyed and retweeted and said in so many ways that people don't hear it anymore. But it's the fundamental truth. Your experience is your experience.
right.
Nobody else's. And, scapegoating it on somebody might make you feel better in the moment, but it doesn't create intimacy and it doesn't access truth.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of really deep stuff, and I want to go in there, but we will in a moment. But I can see, because just getting a little vibe from the type of person that you are, and you it sounds to me like you're somebody, you like to go beneath the surface, you like to go peel the layers away, and I honestly, in 15 minutes or whatever talking to you, I can see you getting frustrated from being in that divorce lawyer world, because I wish I could talk to these people 12 months earlier or 18 months, whatever, to really get into this stuff, at the point of, as you say, visiting a divorce lawyer, kind of too late. So I'm curious to just understand, you know, what you're going through as you're doing this work.
Well, it's one question, because at the time I was one human being, and now I'm a different sort of guy. You know, at the time I had a sense of what you are noticing here. I knew that I wasn't fulfilled, and I really had a hard time with being scapegoated myself by clients. Hmm. That is a thing that happens in divorce law, let me tell you. Clients scapegoat their lawyers. And that was tough for me. But I was money, my friend. And I had social status, and I had really nice suits that I loved wearing. I just look back on it, and I was dating beautiful girls, and I was going to cool events in this beautiful city, and I wasn't going to get off that train. You know, as much as I knew I wasn't fulfilled, and as much as I knew there might be something else, I was on that train and I was riding it. You know, a series of events occurred that forced me out of it, and at the time felt traumatic, and I look back with so much gratitude. So happy for it now. But you know, I was forced out. So
I'd like to go there for a bit, just to understand a little bit better, you know, that sort of the pattern of events and just to better understand, you know, what was going on, sure, if we may.
Yeah. Well, I'll nutshell it, because bits can be long, and then you tell me what you want to hear.
Sure.
More. So
yeah,
I went to Tibet, put my guide's risk in Tibet. I wasn't there to be a spiritual guy. I was just a tourist, and was led around by this lovely man, and I ended up putting his family and his livelihood at risk just by being an entitled white guy and not having any self-awareness of what I was doing. And when I came face to face with that, was mortified isn't even the word. I broke. I realized that I had irreparably harmed this man's entire family and could do nothing about it. And it broke me. It turned out that the harm I thought I had caused was not caused. So luck would have it that I got to sit with horrendous consequences of my being, but didn't actually have to face them. And so I got all the benefit without any of the harm to this guy. And when I came back to San Francisco and tried to step back into my life, it just didn't have any substance anymore. I couldn't grip onto it. And I didn't want to date the way I had been dating. And this is when I met my life partner that I'm with now. I couldn't listen to my clients' bullshit anymore. You know, I just didn't care. I guess that's not totally true. I cared, but I didn't believe it.
Yeah.
And it was at that time that I started considering selling my law firm to my partner. I looked into the books and discovered that he was up to some, let me just nutshell it and say hijinks. And that sent my universe into a tailspin. I ended up lost the entire firm as a result of what he'd been doing. And I lost all of my money, assets, my furniture, my apartment, all the stuff that I thought mattered, or some of the stuff that I thought mattered. And in the wake of that explosion, you know, that loss of stuff, I was very depressed and angry, and I was looking for someone to blame, and I was blaming my partner. But I was also simultaneously asking myself this question: what is actually true? You know, what matters? Everything that I thought mattered and everything that I thought was true is not just destroyed, but appears now to be an illusion. So what in God's name is true? You know, what matters? And I sat on my couch next to my little dog for, I think, 9 months. Basically catatonic, asking that question and playing a driving game on my iPad. I don't know why my girlfriend stuck with me through that phase, but blessings on her, she did. And I just processed that question. And it was, outwardly, it looked like a depression. Inwardly, it felt like fire and explosions. I was journaling at the time, and I look back on those notes, and I was just pouring out this existential vitriol. And then one day it passed, the anger and the storm passed, and I didn't have an answer, but I noticed I was peaceful. And then about a week later, I was having a sip of coffee in a cafe, and I was reading a quote from a writer, an Indian writer named Jiddu Krishnamurti, and he, with one sentence, spoke to what I had been going through. He said, oh, by the way, you know, your mind and all its chatter and drama and whatever, I'm paraphrasing because I have no idea how he actually said it, your mind, it's not going anywhere. It's always going to be there. And I'm having this sip of coffee, thinking about that sentence, and all of a sudden, I got to tell you, it was as if a nuclear bomb of happiness went off. The world just absolutely, thoroughly, completely changed in that moment. And it has never been the same since. It was characterized by some cascading kind of existential realizations. You know, everything is perfect exactly as it is, including your desire to change it and your fear. And then, you know, the spiritual mumbo jumbo one that you hear all the time, which is all things are one thing. That finally clicked in for me. But that they're all separate things also, and that it's a big joke, you know, and several other realizations all sort of kicked in at the same time. And I was left with this sense of bliss like I've never experienced. It lasted for a month. And then, and at the end of that month, my girlfriend came home from a trip. She'd been on a work trip that whole month. And we got into a knockdown, drag-out fight. Wherein I realized, oh, I'm not enlightened.
Right.
Okay, I'm not enlightened. I'm having a fight. What's the deal? And the fight was so painful because of the contrast with this joy I'd been sitting in, like a stupefied, I don't even know what, for a month. And... And then I learned sort of a lesson that carries me now, which is, the joy and the truth and the peace and all of that, it's not in the doing, it's in the allowing.
Wow. And
that's what carries me forward now. That's what carried me forward, and that it's that sort of that simple insight that carries me into the projects that I do now, and this podcast that I'm running, and the radio program I now have. Magazine and everything else. So,
wow.
I guess I didn't nutshell that as well as I hope, but that's the story.
No, that's really awesome. That's very profound. And I guess when you say the allowing, do you mean letting it? Because it's a little bit. I'm seeing some connections and parallels going on here, but it is kind of like a relationship. And this is also why I have perhaps a little bit of a, you know, feel a little bit uncomfortable in talking about this topic, because as a risk management guy, so it's, you know, you want to do this, and then there are these things in the way, and they're called risks, and you do what you can to minimize them, or to, you know, get, and it can be a very linear kind of process, but at the end of the day, it's a goal oriented. You know, I can be very goal oriented. A lot of people that I, you know, that are my friends are goal oriented, and it sounds perhaps like you were as well. Allowing is kind of like, you know, if you experience a good relationship, it's always the allowing that makes it work.
Yeah. And you know, there's nothing wrong with goal orientation. Mm-hmm. On it, really, there's nothing wrong with it. That said, there's a way that there's a fundamental illusion at play most of the time when we're setting goals, or a fundamental flaw in our thinking, which is that something really is wrong and I'm going to fix it and then everything will be better. I'll be happier. You know, I'll finally be at peace and satisfied. People will love me when X occurs. And that's right. That's not the case.
Right. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Fucking now. It's fine now. It's actually not fine. It's amazing right now. And also, sure, change it if you want. No big deal. Change it. Go for it. Do it. But get that it is genius in this exact instant. And if you can have that paradox present, then you'll, I've noticed the goals unfold much more gracefully and naturally.
Yes.
And that's where the allowing occurs. Like, allow that you want the goal. Allow that the world is as it is. Allow it to unfold, as opposed to forcing it and it and trying to manipulate it. You know, that's, and then the other half of that is when those goals get achieved, I've noticed if I'm doing it from the place of manipulation, I'm never satisfied. If the goal comes to fruition from the place of allowing, it's joy. It's absolute joy, because it's joy through the whole process. You know, it's not buying into the conclusion that things will be good when.
Yes. It's a lot like the concept of flow and being present and all these things that we hear about, but are so hard to practice.
Yeah. I liken it to, you know, we're walking this knife's edge in life between the two existential realities, or these two nested realities. On one hand, it's just clear nothing matters. You know, you fundamentally, you know, all the stuff you think matters doesn't. And there's no objective arbiter of good or bad or happiness or sadness. You know, it's just, it's arbitrary. It's a social construct. You know that deep down. On the other hand, you are having this experience where you want stuff. You know, you want to make money. You want to have a beautiful partner in your life. You know, this, and that's fine too. And walking the knife's edge between those two both legitimate realities is this, it's this holding, allowing of this paradox. And, you know, and I, you're right about flow. Like, when it kicks in, it's just so graceful. It's just so much ease when it kicks in. And that kicking in comes through the allowing.
That's very, yeah, very cool. Very cool. Let's bring love and relationships into this. I'd like to just explore now how you know, sort of gone. Where did the concept of, you know, I want to talk to couples about their relationships, and I want to. Were you thinking about bringing some of your experience as a divorce lawyer into this sort of new outlook that you had on the world? What?
Well, I guess two answers to that, as to all things. The surface answer is the most fun thing that I did when I was a divorce lawyer is I was granted a kind of privilege to ask people real questions, like honest, deep issues that they don't normally face.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And then they would, by and large, tell me the truth because they knew they needed to in order to, for me to operate their case properly. And we would end up having these lovely, lovely conversations. And I always thought, wouldn't it be so great to be able to record these? So that was where it began, really. And then, you know, after the firm was over and I was thinking, well, if everything's perfect and there's nothing to do, what do I do? And I was like, well, those conversations, man, those were good. Let's have some conversations. And why don't I record? And hey, that's a podcast.
Yeah.
So I started reaching out to folks and asking if they wanted to be on a show, and to my surprise, most people said yes. So I put 50 interviews in the can, and then launched the show. And that's what the that's all my show is. You know, it's sort of, I guess, what you are doing. It's just a conversation with
people,
but trying to get down below what you talk about at a cocktail party and access what, come on, what's really going on with you guys?
Yeah. I mean, it's excellent. I listened to a few episodes, and the one with Dr. Helen Fisher, she's great. She's, yeah. And I love how some of the, you know, some of the couples on the show are, how open they are. Yeah. It's very revealing. And to me, a conversation's like a piece of artwork that you'll get something out of that conversation that might be a little different from the next person. So you can see a little bit. The reason why we connect is because we can see a little bit of ourselves in those conversations.
That is
so it's,
what it, yeah, it is. It's each conversation is a piece of artwork. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, I think this is why there is a, this is why this is the golden age of radio and podcasting and all of that good stuff. And you're connecting, you make a connection with, you know, with not only with a guest like you and I are doing, but, you know, the people out there that are, you know, connecting with, will be connecting with us. It's, you know, it's just wonderful. And we don't have enough of that.
Right. Yeah.
The world is too fast paced. We're tweeting, we're, you know, social media, all this stuff. I'd like to talk about some of the themes that came out, both, you know, some of the themes in your conversations and some of the themes that come out in some of your podcast episodes with regard to relationships. And, you know, relationships are, a marriage is certainly a big, potentially is a huge risk that we all take. So we sometimes we know it and sometimes we don't. but, you know, what are some of the, let's talk about one theme for example, fighting, right? So you talked about a fight that you had and, you know, couples all have their disputes and their fights and things like this, but,
whether they admit
what have you, yeah, whether they admit, I mean, no one says, yeah, you know, I think the idea of romantic love to, in my own view is, okay, that's great, but that's the sort of, you know, teenage type of stuff, right? Anybody who's made it, I've been married 15 and a half years, so anyone who's made it, you know, sort of that far knows that it's all work. Not all work, but there's a lot of work involved. So, you know, you have your moments where there are disagreements, but, you know, just I'm curious to get your take on the concept of, say, conflict in relationships.
Well, you know, conflict is the access to our experience in this world. I mean, fundamentally, we are defined by our limitations. You know, we are what we are not, in some sense, and you know, our experience in this world is defined by bumping up against others and our inabilities, and that, you know, it's on one level or another, those limitations feel like some kind of pain. You know, that we are designed to experience pain when we hit a limit. It's an abstraction and expression of death and death avoidance. You know, it's how we're biologically built, I think. So that's the broader picture. And then you get into a relationship where survival and procreation are fundamentally implicated. And then you create on top of that this concept of commitment, lifelong commitment, which is, you know, holy cow, what a what a big abstract. Layer that on top. And then all of the social constraints that we're up against and expectations. And there's this immense amount of pressure that activates our deepest unresolved stuff. And that's why you see in relationships, people find their greatest joy and satisfaction and connection and intimacy, and they have their worst, most existential fears and fights. And you know, you know how it is in your marriage, if you guys are fighting about something, everything else is gray. You know, most people can't just go into the rest of their life and be normal if they're in a horrible conflict with their spouse. Yeah. And that's for this reason, because, you know, it's the most intimate looking glass into our deepest, truest, most unresolved, unarticulated, unconscious selves. And so when a conflict arises, it's this gorgeous, gorgeous opportunity to say, what's going on there? You know, because the experience that each of us is having in that moment of anger and pain and frustration and blame and denial is our own experience. And as much as we want to say, hey, that's your fault, honey, you shouldn't have said that thing to me. Maybe she shouldn't have, but the experience that you had as a result of her saying it is yours. And it's a looking glass into what's really going on for who and what you are.
Wow. Yeah.
That's the beauty of those moments. I mean, you get to really look if you want to, if you're willing, if you can.
That's awesome. That is awesome. I mean, just thinking about, like, I consider myself a relatively intelligent guy. But, you know, sometimes in those situations, you're like, oh, for fuck's sake, why did I say that? Now I have to, like, unwind the clock. It's impossible, right? So
it is impossible. And also, you've got to give yourself some, I do anyway, have to give myself some compassion in those moments, because the fights are going to happen when you're under-resourced. You know, if you're happy, you know, and everything's going well with your finances and you've got plenty of sleep the night before and your belly's full, you know, stupid, it's a lot easier to let it slide off and not react in a way that makes it
right.
But if you're sick, like this last weekend, oh my God, it was my partner's birthday. We both have the flu. We were traveling because we were on a birthday trip for her. And we hadn't slept the night before because we were sick and the dog was up all night. And I don't even remember how it started. One of us said something stupid and it turned into a actual like like a screaming match fight. And we were on the beach and nobody was around, and we had enough self-awareness to know that it was pretty stupid. So we were laughing as we were yelling. It was sort of a funny thing. We were laughing as we were yelling, but we were yelling. And,
right.
And we, you know, afterwards, after it all passed, we're both like, wow, I don't think we could have avoided that. I don't think there, you know, like 3 hours of sleep and the flu, hungry bellies. I don't think that could have been avoided. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that's why fights always happen at the worst possible time.
Yeah.
You're about to go out, or you're about to something, you know, whatever. It seems like, or it's, you know, it kicks off at 11:30 PM when you're about to, you know, you need to go to bed and all that stuff. So, it does make a lot of sense. It does make a lot of sense. Are any thoughts on, how, couples can, I don't know, fight in the best possible way.
That's a funny idea. I mean, so I had this famous therapist couple on the show about a year ago, and they said, and I asked them that same question, and they said, hey, if it's a fight, it's a fight. You know, there is no such thing as fighting fair. A fight is a fight.
Mm-hmm.
Their fundamental plan in those situations is to remember afterwards that it's not the end of the universe, you know, and then to deconstruct what happened so they can learn from it. And I think that's true. I think if it's a full blown fight, it's a full blown fight. You're probably not going to have a lot of self control. The best you can do is have some compassion for yourself and your partner afterwards. But there are those disagreements where we have self awareness. I mean, I think the out and out fights are pretty uncommon for most of us, but uncomfortable disagreements and annoyances that we bury and feel slight resentment, that's all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in those moments, there are some basic tricks. The first trick, the number one most important trick probably is, to get out of your lizard brain. You know, you've just got to get out of your fight or flight or freeze, reaction. And there are some ways to do that. You know, you hear about deep breathing, taking 10 seconds to not react and saying, so, hey, I'm going to not react. Give me a second here. And during that time, take the deep breath, Another good trick is to widen your peripheral vision intentionally. When we're in fight, fight, or freeze, our vision narrows. We get tunnel vision. It's, you know, it's just the way that we can conserve resources so we can survive. And but it's just not particularly useful in a fight. So widen your peripheral vision, and that will kick in the rationality of your mind. So there's some basic tricks that you can apply, and everybody's got their tricks, but apply them. You know, apply them so that you can get out of your instinctive animal reaction, whatever it is. Because if you want to run, you're abandoning your partner. That's not going to work. If you want to fight, you're exasperating something that probably doesn't need to be amplified in that moment. And if you're freezing, you're not engaged. None of those are particularly useful. So that's the first step. Then the second step is to remember fundamentally that this is not terminal. You know, the disagreement is inevitable. It's not terminal.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can take it to, well, how can we actually use this disagreement to learn something about ourselves?
Right. I think that's that's probably the key thing. The last, you know, that last step. And I think, just thinking about my own experiences, you know, when you're in that sort of early stages of a relationship, I think that first fight or those first disagreements can be can feel catastrophic.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many you know couples you know get you break up after that sort of that first fight, but it can, you know, I'm sure it can feel, it can feel like it's the end of the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, similarly, you know, I suppose there are tons of couples that get in the same fights all the time without taking that last step, which is also not sustainable. Or it's a recipe for ongoing unhappiness, perhaps.
The last step.
But, yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
To look at yourself and be.
You have to look inside. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a. First of all, people don't know how to do it, which we're not trained how to do that in life. Then it takes some real courage to be honest about this, you know?
Yeah.
It's tough. And to riff on what you were saying about that first fight, you're right. That breaks up a lot of people. And it's just because they're laboring under the illusion that that the dopamine and serotonin honeymoon phase was...
Yeah.
The eternal
truth. Will last forever. Yeah.
That's okay.
When you were you know, doing your work as a divorce lawyer, or, you know, through some of the people that you've been talking to, at what point in the marriage do divorces commonly happen?
It's like Helen Fisher said in that interview that you listened to.
Four years, was it?
Yeah, they happen around
here.
There's another phase, I think, if I remember the stats, that kicks in somewhere in the teens. But that first one is year four. And there's some good biological reasons for it. I think Helen Fisher's assessment of that is spot on. You know, we're biologically designed to procreate and then to rear our young to the point where they can survive without us in a village environment. And then we split up so we can go procreate with other people, which creates more diverse offspring, which makes us species. And, you know, that's who we are as animals, and nothing wrong with it. That said, now we're in the society where we want to extend that relationship. And so when the year four, you know, chemical passion starts to drop off, the fights seem more significant than they did before. Mm-hmm. When you're ready to jump right back in the sack because you love everything about that person, the fight doesn't matter so much. Mm-hmm. When you're, you know, maybe those chemicals aren't so strong, and you have the fight, it seems a little more real now. It seems a little more critical. And again, I'm agnostic here. I don't care if people stay together or break up. But whatever they do, this is a great opportunity. It's a great opportunity to learn what's really going on. And if they stick together through that, there's something on the other side of a long-term relationship that's not available anywhere else.
Right.
You know, if it's a conscious one, there's a level of intimacy and frankly, good sex that is just not available anywhere else. To monks on the mountain meditating and understanding truth, it's not available. There is something about exposing and fundamentally breaking yourself down to the point where you can be with another human that is that's an unsurpassable mystery.
Yeah, that is awesome. Unfortunately, not many of us get there. It would seem. Well, maybe not. Maybe I don't know. Just I'm thinking about divorce rates and things. But what you say is interesting. I don't care if people get divorced. Actually, it's probably you're probably right that in many cases people who get divorced likely should, provided they learn something from it and take that into their next relationship. Maybe that's a way of getting there, though it's an expensive way of getting there, which is. It's also interesting given that I don't know what marriage rates are amongst the younger millennials, but it would appear to me that there's that they're not getting married as readily as our generation or my generation.
Yeah, that does seem to be the trend. Although I don't know that it's they're not being married; is that they're just waiting longer,
right?
Stats do show the older and the more educated you are, the more likely your marriage is to succeed.
Right, right.
There's certainly some wisdom in that, in waiting.
That makes sense.
Your goal, which I I'm agnostic. I don't know that it needs to be.
What's your take on monogamy? Are we designed to be monogamous or not?
I don't think we're designed one where that's a tough one. So if you listen to that Helen Fisher episode, she has a view there that we're designed to pair bond.
Yes.
But for a period of time and then it ends. So yes. we're monogamous for a period and then we're not. And I think biologically, developmentally, she's probably right. There's a countervailing argument out there, which is expressed in, what is the famous book? There's several famous non-monogamy books, Sex at Dawn and The Ethical Slut, which basically lay out arguments that were designed to be non-monogamous in order to diversify the strength of the species, etc. And I get those too. And fundamentally, I guess I don't care. What I love is that as we have more access to resources as a society, as we're less financially dependent upon one another for our survival, individual humans are able to make inquiries into what they really want in life. And that's, basically women's access to financial independence is causing us to rethink our sexual interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, the answer is non-monogamy. We've had a lot of non-monogamous couples on our show.
Yes.
And I just want to buck one trend, which is that I think every single one of those relationships that we've had on the show was requested by the female partner. There's this stereotype out there that non-monogamous couples are really just some guy who's horny manipulating his female partners into doing this thing because they want to be monogamous with him but they're willing to put up with it, and that is just not the case, my friends. By and large, from what I can tell, women who want the non-monogamous relationship,
right?
And it's because they're they're exploring what they really want in life now, and because they can. And, Helen Fisher's view is that it's going to end up, people are going to have this great exploration and end up pair bonding and having monogamous relationships. They're just going to kick in later. That could be the case. I don't know what's ultimately going to happen, but I am 150% for that personal exploration. I mean, it's just yet one more way to access what's true and what matters. Sexuality and your own personal needs. In that regard. So
yeah, that's you know, that's certainly I think that's beautifully put. And in terms of and I think social norms are obviously, you know, social norms are always changing, but it seems to me like in the last 15 or 20 years that they've changed quite rapidly in Western countries. Of course, you know, you go a little bit further afield, and you get a lot of traditional, you know, gender roles and perceptions about marriage. You still have, you know, we still have arranged marriages in many parts of the world. Lots of societal pressures around class. You know, it's amazing what still goes on, but then not amazing when you think about, you know, where certain, you know, certain cultures are. I don't know if you have any views on cross-cultural marriages.
Right. Okay, so
I'm in one, by the way, so it's a bit of I'm biased, but
I love them.
Yeah.
So before I answer that question, let me answer something that you alluded to when you were asking it.
Sure.
Which is this notion of traditional marriage. Let me just say, traditional marriage is a subjective idea. You know, you've got Inuits and Tibetans who multiple brothers marry one woman. You've got ghost marriages in China. You've got infant marriages in Africa and parts of India. And all of these kinds of marriages are considered traditional in those areas. And if you're a good person, you do what the traditional thing is. And they think everybody else is crazy. And arranged marriages, by the way, have the lowest divorce rate in the world. Numbers are all over the map for the stats, but it seems to be somewhere in the 2 to 15% range. Depending on the country. Versus love marriages, which, as you know, have a 45 to 50% divorce rate around the world. So tradition is as tradition does. And that brings me around to your question, which is how do intercultural marriages work? And the answer is they do. They work great. It's just they're a little more spicy. You know, because we all think that the way we were raised is the right way to be. And then we assume that if our partner was just being rational, they would know that it was the right way to be too. And so that creates some spice. The fundamental truth is, folks, neither of these ways are the quote unquote right way to be. There is no right way to be. Your marriage is your marriage. Your parenting is your parenting. You get to make it up as you go. And it's a lot easier, frankly, to just buy the standard off the shelf package marriage traditions and marry some same culture.
But
wow, how much more fun. What a much more opportunity to shake yourself up and again ask the question that I care about, what the heck is true here, than by getting into a relationship with somebody who has a completely different set of operating systems.
That's awesome. That's I love the way you think about that. The one area that that is interesting. Actually, I don't know if you came across this, but I read an article that said the more that there's an inverse correlation between the cost of a couple's of the engagement ring that a man gives a woman and divorce rates. In other words, the more expensive the engagement ring, the more likely the marriage will end up in divorce. And I can also see a lot of from time to time you see these, you know, couples who spend a lot of time planning the actual wedding day versus, you know, the rest of their lives. I think you probably have to do both, but you know, it's great to have a wonderful, you know, wedding, but you know, you have to think about what goes on after that. So, I think there is still a lot of societal pressure, even in Western societies, around weddings and, you know, expectations and things like this. It's a huge industry.
It's a huge industry, and it's a huge kind of cultural set piece. You know, I mean, that's just one thing you do. You graduate from college, you get a job. You have the wedding. You go to the wedding. You have a registry.
Yes.
Thing, you buy a house. The things you're supposed to do. Nothing wrong with it. But Mike, if you get caught up in that, that's what it's all about. You're going to be disappointed.
Yes. Yes. I guess speaking of which, and one of the themes around my show is that of resilience. And I mean, resilience is sort of the inverse in some ways of risk and uncertainty when things don't go your way. How can we bounce back? How can we, learn and move forward? I love the concept of, your take on conflict, your own arc. And what you learned, and I don't know if you like the movie Fight Club. It's one of my favorite movies.
That's interesting. Tell me why. I mean, I do love it, but
for a number of reasons. But it's one of my favorite parts of that movie is when Brad Pitt pours the lie on Edward Norton's the back of his hand, and said, "This is the greatest moment of your life." And it's only I forget the exact line, but it's only after we've lost everything that we can do anything or something to those, to that effect.
I haven't watched that darn movie since I had my
I love that scene. That.
And wow, how true.
Yeah, I mean, I love that scene. And there is something about, about whether it's, whether it's conflict. It doesn't have to be conflict, but it has to be, adversity, difficulty, obstacles. That's when people grow, and you have to put yourself in some of these positions. And, if we apply that lens to, relationships, something that, a failed marriage, a failed, breakup or whatever, there is something at the other end of it. And it's, you don't want to tell that to the person that's sort of at rock bottom. If I went up to you when you found out that your partner had done these nefarious things and said, "This is the greatest moment of your life," I think you'd try and punch me. But but still, there's when you say seek truth, those are moments when we can seek some sort of truth. And I don't think that we have to hit rock bottom. I've been playing around with this idea because I've never sort of hit a rock bottom, but and I hope I don't. But when there are moments of adversity, we can learn. And so with that in mind, I'm just thinking about somebody who's been through a divorce, a breakup, who's trying to put the pieces back together in their lives. What have you found in either the work that you've done with clients, with some of your podcast guests? What sticks out for you?
Well, on the surface level, I think the first thing to acknowledge when we're experiencing that kind of pain is, hey, we're experiencing pain. It's like, just allow it for a minute. Mm-hmm. And have some compassion for it. And also know it's going to pass. The pain passes. Pain is every emotion, the happy, the joy, it's all, it's temporary. The feelings flow through, they come, they go. They're not who we are. They're not what we are. They're a thing that's occurring. They're flickers of light on a screen. Great. Enjoy them. The suffering that we then layer upon ourselves is rooted in what we care about, in what we believe. You said, how did you put it? When people have hit rock bottom or when they've hit a great loss, it's very, it's painful. And that's only true if you care. Not in a flippant way, but it's only true if you believe that it's true. It's a loss if you believe it's a loss. It's a bad thing if you believe it's a bad thing. Otherwise, it's just a thing. And that pain is access to what you believe. because it's only painful because of the belief. Mm-hmm. And the belief is arbitrary. And you can't not have beliefs. You're going to have beliefs, but get that they're arbitrary. And don't attach this existential meaning to it, because that's lifelong suffering. The pain passes. So does the joy. Mm-hmm. So does the the suffering, the holding yourself down and making it be that this is the truth about who you are and the world is the worst thing ever and et cetera, that is a flawed belief system in what's true and what matters. And that's another way of accessing allowing, you know, when you can let go, when you can surrender to, yeah, there's pain. Yeah, there's loss. Surrender to it. Then it can pass. And then something new can arise afterwards, which it always does. I don't know if that answered your question now that I've just said
it. I think it did. It's a very sort of Zen way of answering the question. It takes work, doesn't it? I mean, it's hard when you're in that, you know, you're in that moment. It doesn't have to be a relationship. It can be anything, but it's difficult when you're in that moment. But
in those moments where the pain is really strong, because we all experience them, I think the Dalai Lama included, and certainly for goodness sakes me, experiences these moments, but there's a kind of glimmer of perspective that's always available. Tell me if you've noticed this in your deepest, most unhappy moments, you can always kind of distill out this little feeling of joy or enjoyment or even just neutrality. There's a way in those moments where we all, if we're being really quiet and honest with ourselves, can feel the sense of nothing, the sense of neutrality. And if you can just even catch a whisper of that, a glimmer of that fact, then you can see that feeling you're having on top of it, the interpretation on top of it, is just made up by you.
Yeah.
And go with it if you want. Sometimes you need to. Sometimes that's your access to your
next. Yeah. That's,
but you can see that it's yours.
Yeah. Yeah. But dude, that takes work, right? First of all, I think that's always available to us. I think meditation is a great thing. And that's one way of accessing that, or trying to access that. But, I think for most people, it's a process. Maybe there are those that can, that are able to do that more instantaneously. And I actually think you can train yourself. Even when things are great, you can kind of, you know that it can be fleeting, and you know that there are things that can, can change that, for any number of reasons. And then that kind of helps if and when they do.
Yeah.
It's a practice.
It's gotta be a practice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You think of it as when I hear the word practice, I think of exercise or something.
Yeah.
Oh, right now I got to do that.
Right.
Is that how it is for you?
I think that, a meditation practice helps, because you kind of notice stuff. I mean, I don't know what the mechanism is, and I think there is there's some scientific benefits around it. It doesn't mean that you're practicing it all the time, but I mean, I think it means, so when say you're with your other half and you're really enjoying it, you're just really enjoying it, and nothing else matters, because you're trying to, just like you and I are having this conversation, I've shut off my phone and I don't have any distractions, and I'm not thinking about, the next thing I have to do. But it's hard to be in that place. And I think if we are in that place in relationships and just enjoying the time with one another and, you know, and all the rest, as much as possible, then that, you know, that contributes, that is a practice that contributes, because you're not only acknowledging the, you know, the sort of wonder of the moment that you're in, you're also acknowledging the fact that it can go away. And then if and when it does, you also have access to the fact that this is, you know, yeah, it's, as you say, it's painful, it's shitty, it's whatever, but I also know that this can go away too. And, you know, I have some tools to, you know, at my disposal to try and help make that happen.
Yeah.
And for some people, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I don't know if it's what you were saying, but I think this is what you were saying too, that it can go away applies to the bad feeling that you're probably wanting.
Yes. Yes.
But it also applies to all the good stuff too.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
That is the secret to the whole thing. You know, it's all impermanent.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think, you know, makes, you know, hopefully makes you appreciate the good stuff more. And that's, you know, when we talk about, you know, I talk about risk and uncertainty, and to me, risk isn't a bad thing. It's not always a bad thing. It can be, you know, a good thing. But this, to me, this is very much linked to uncertainty, because we don't know. We don't know what is going to happen, you know, tomorrow or next year or whatever. We have a good idea. We can, you know, we can extrapolate a little bit in terms of trends and how things are going and all the rest, but we also don't, you know, at the end of the day, we don't know fully. And this is, to me, this is part of being, you know, being resilient, is also about being present. It's about, you know, enjoying when, you know, when we are enjoying a great relationship, love, you know, all of that. But similarly, I think it's something that can be useful when things don't go so well.
Can I share something that's been running through my head around that lately?
Please.
So I recently, a couple of years ago, went to Six Flags, the roller coaster park, and right. bought the you know, passes where you can skip the line. Best thing ever. You go up to the front of the line. You don't have to wait in line. So you can just go to roller coaster after coaster after coaster after coaster.
Yeah.
And I noticed that when I first got on the roller coaster, that, you know, the very first one, it was extra terrifying and exhilarating because I was resisting the roller coaster. I was resisting that first drop over the over the thing.
Yeah.
By the end of the day, we had ridden so many roller coasters.
Right.
I couldn't get any ounce of
food. Right. Right.
But in the middle of the day, there was this moment where I realized that it was the most fun when I would surrender to dipping over the edge. I wasn't holding back. You know, my muscles weren't tight, kind of like that unconscious animal wasn't trying to get away from that. We were about to go over the edge.
Yeah.
I was leaning into and being fully relaxed in the dip over. And I've carried that with me. I now, if I'm having some experience in life that feels risky or scary, I actually find myself imagining surrendering to the roller coaster. Then the experience in the moment gets really, really fun.
Yeah.
You know, it just gets really fun. It's so much easier to ride the roller coaster in the direction it's going.
That's right. That's awesome. And that's, you know, that's a great, you know, I think that's a great, when you talk about surrender, I mean, that's, I think that's a similar idea in a relationship. You kind of have to surrender to it and just see where it goes. I practice martial arts, and there's another connection I'm going to throw out. And, you know, these are all sort of interesting, tenuous, possibly tenuous connections, but to me, they're interesting. And one of that is, you know, to do a movement in martial arts well, you have to be relaxed. Mm-hmm. If you're too stiff, you know, you could possibly hurt yourself, but you're not going to do the movement correctly. The grandmaster who sort of teaches in our school, I mean, he's got an analogy of a of a branch that's alive versus one that's dead, and the, you know, the dead one's stiff, and when you bend it, it breaks in half, and the live one is supple, and you know, you can bend it and all that stuff. And that's, you know, to me, what you're describing is how to be alive. Mm-hmm. And that's a great way to live, right? And it's also a great way to live with risk and uncertainty. So when we have to do all this sort of planning, and it's great to, I don't know, prenuptial agreements might be great in a marriage and all of that stuff. But, you know, you have to be alive in the relationship. You have to kind of, you know, it's like it is like a dance. It's like a, you know, your partner grows, you have to, you're growing, and hopefully you're growing in the same direction, but maybe you won't. You do have to put a bit of, you know, you have to put a bit of work, but that concept of surrender is it's very interesting. I think it's a great way of living and living with another human being.
That's a great analogy. Wow, your grandmaster's wonderful. It makes me want to go take a martial art.
Yeah. We've been going. Well over an hour now, and I want to be respectful of your time, where can people find you a little in the social media and the internet, and you know, find a little bit more about your podcast, your guide? I mean, there's some fabulous stuff on there. Where can people find that?
Well, the easiest way is to go to our website, together.show.
Okay.
And that, you know, from there you can find our Together podcast, which is also available on every podcast player that there is, as you know how that goes.
Yeah.
Also, you know, social media. I would love to have you on Twitter, Facebook, but all that's available at together.show. And we've just launched a radio program on the Sports Byline radio network, which broadcasts all over the world. So if you happen to be listening to Sports Byline, you'll probably hear me pop up and spout some relationship advice for a minute at a time.
So cool. That's a lot
of fun, but primarily cool. At together.show.
That's awesome. I feel like I keep talking to you, so I don't, but I want to, you know, I want to be respectful of your time. So, I would like to sort of, wrap it up soon, but is there anything that we didn't talk about that you feel like it's worth mentioning, it's worth discussing?
Oh, wow, let's see, a blank canvas, is it?
I mean, there are a couple areas that are really interesting to me,
ask away. I mean, I'm...
Yeah, well, look, it's been several years since I was sort of out there dating, and the whole mechanism seems really different with online dating and stuff like that. I know you've got a sponsor, that's Match.com, I think. How has that, you know, has that changed? How has that changed? Is there an algorithm to match people, this, you know, big data and all this stuff, or how much of it is, you know, more traditional dating techniques? What's going on there? What's your take on what's going on?
Well, I've never billed myself as much of a dating expert. That said, because Match is our sponsor right now, I've been researching a lot about how it operates. And the data seems to say that, more and more people are meeting online. I think it's a third of all relationships now start online. And that number increases every year.
Yeah.
But what's more important about it is that when people get past the stigma of dating online, and also the addiction, which is the other half of it, they're able to hone in what they actually want and be more effective about targeting that, which is how and why dating online works. When it works, it's effective because someone is self-aware enough to be able to target what they're really looking for in a relationship. So if you can get through the stigma hurdle and into it, that's the benefit. What the danger then on the other side, once you're in, is that it becomes really addicting to just go next,
right?
Next, something better, something more, something sexier, somebody richer, smarter, whatever. I think that is coded into who we are, you know, as we're always seeking to improve. That's a way of flipping the fear mechanism on its head, is the fear driving us to change. And the change is to improve so that we can be more efficient, maybe program, whatever. But it gets out of control online because we haven't evolved to be able to manage that amount of input that's accessible online. And Helen Fisher, in that same interview we referenced so many times, had a really great solution to that. And it's research based. If you get yourself online and you can hone in on what you're looking for, set yourself a limit of the number of people you're going to interact with at any one time. You know, don't go on Tinder and swipe and swipe and swipe and swipe ad nauseum, you know, every time you have a moment with your phone. That's not going to get you anywhere. Instead, give yourself a maximum number of other human beings to interact with. Probably set it at 5 or 6 or 7, because that's about what a person can emotionally manage. Mm-hmm. And get to know those folks. Really do. You know, set your standards for what you're looking for and get to know these 5 or 6 people. And, you know, they're not going to be perfect because nobody is. You're going to notice that one profile photo was awful, or that the thing they said about their ex-girlfriend in the profile, they shouldn't have written that, or they're kind of dorky in that email they sent you. Overlook those. Just really, you know, everybody's flawed. Overlook some of the flaws and get to know these people. And then, you know, then it's okay to say no. It's really after you've given them a shot, it's okay to say no to those folks and start with another batch of 5 or 6. But don't move on until you've taken the time to actually really invest. That's the way to use the benefit of online dating without getting sucked into the addiction of it.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I think, you know, it used to be, well, you know, people could date people in the same, you know, the same neighborhood, school, then town, then, you know, city, etc. And then, you know, we've kind of extended it to almost, you know, the entire, you know, not quite the entire world, but, you know, it's there's a paradox with too much choice.
Yeah.
It can make our head spin, whether it's, you know,
it's true.
Choosing
all that choice, it doesn't make us better, and seeking perfection doesn't. I had a couple on the show yesterday. I haven't released the interview yet. They're an Indian couple, and they didn't have an arranged marriage, but they met one another in the Indian community and then put their relationship into the kind of family mechanism that arranged marriages follow.
Right.
And they got married really fast, and then they really learned how to love each other during their first year of marriage. And they started the show by saying, you know, he and she are my soulmate. And after 20 minutes, I questioned. I said, really? Your soulmate? Your soulmate? Because you didn't even know how to love each other until you were married. And they both said, okay, you're right. The truth is, we recognized that we were each good enough.
Right.
You know, it's just good enough.
Right.
And then we realized if you're good enough, you can make it amazing.
Yeah.
And there is so much wisdom in that. You know, if it's good enough to be good, it's good enough to be phenomenal if you're willing to do the work. And that's the illusion that we're laboring under in the West. So you can find this perfect Prince Charming who does not exist. Your ideal mate does not exist. And you are not your partner's ideal mate either. Because nobody...
You have to put in the work.
Yeah. And you have this internal thing that's not... doesn't exist in reality. You have this internal idea generated from 20 years, 30 years, 40 years of fantasy movies spouted by Disney.
Yeah.
And they don't exist.
Yeah.
But a human being does exist with whom you can have a phenomenal relationship if you're willing to.
Yeah. That's beautifully put. I think that's actually a great way to end it and wrap things up. But Eric, this has been phenomenal. I've really enjoyed this.
Ben, thanks for having me. The idea of risk is just so sexy. I've been excited about this conversation.
Happy to talk more, you know, keep the connection going, because risk is risk is life is what I said. That's the tagline of my show. Because without
life is risk. I love
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Without uncertainty, we don't have, I mean, imagine everything was predictable, you know, why bother?
Right.
You know, we knew what the outcomes were. Why bother? You know?
Yeah.
So yeah. And, there's just so much to it, and it's a topic worthy of, some further exploration. So, I'd love to stay connected with you and, you know, see if we could, either do this again or, collaborate in another capacity. I think it'd be great.
Yeah. Anytime you want to, have me on the show, I'd be happy to. And I'd love to have you and your spouse on the show, on my show.
Yeah. I have to run it by her, but there's a very interesting, it's a very interesting story there, in terms of how we met. And, I'll just say I knew because I was working in the Philippines, and the company I was with, they transferred me to Australia at the time, and I should have been super happy. And I was, because I was, you know, working in Australia, and they gave me a membership to a boat club, and, you know, it was supposed to be, you know, having a great time. And I was miserable, and decided, nope, I got to go back, and you've got to do something about this. So, anyway,
I thought you met her.
So we met when I was working in Manila and started to date and so on. And then the company I was with said, we want you to go, work in Sydney, Australia. And, you know, I was, you know, well, how old was I? 29, something like that. I was supposed to be having the time of my life. Right. Wonderful place, you know, decent job, you know, and I was like, oh, I can't stand this. I need to go back. The rest is history.
Yeah. I would love to
do that. Sure.
Come be honest. Sure. Ask her.
Sure. It's
fun and, no pressure.
Great. Okay. Well, yeah, absolutely. I'll let you know, but this is great. Thank you so much. And, look forward to staying connected. And, thank you so much.
All right, brother. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Well, that was really cool. Check out together.guide. That's Eric's website. Once again, and as always, check out the show notes. And, you know, maybe have a think about your own relationship if you are in one and what you want out of it. Or if you aren't, take his advice on online dating. Anyway, I would love to hear what you think of this episode and of the show in general. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. Subscribe, allthingsrisk.co.uk. You can find all ways in which you can subscribe to the podcast. You can get our newsletter, and that way you will ensure that you won't miss anything. We will be back next week, so stay tuned. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.